I'm angry with my mate. I'm miserable in my relationship. Does it ever feel like your mind story, your mind state is completely out of your control? Like maybe you're someone in the Grand Central Station train station in New York City and you don't know your way and you can't read the signs and you're wandering around and you get on any random train you find. And it turns out it's the anger train or the I want a divorce train or the I do not know what I'm going to do next train. Welcome to this special episode, the third of three of Sex, Love, and Elephants that were talks I gave in December at a weekend self-compassion meditation retreat. And each evening I gave a talk. This is the third one. And in this particular episode, I really want you to pay attention to how you are actually responsible for your mood, for your feelings. If you're miserable, get on a different train. Hope you enjoy this episode and stay tuned, babies, because next week I'm going to be kicking off an extraordinary spring session of top love and sex questions, top problems, relationship 911. How do we get in there and fix what's broken? And also, that's a big lead up to the most exciting time of the year. I'll be offering the Become Passion program, my signature 12-week immersion program for couples just like you. We're kicking off right at the beginning of May. You'll hear about that. I hope you'll join me for some free classes, some free Zoom Q&As with me. And then for the full 3-month immersion, where you and your partner can learn to change misery into happiness, connection, and yes, passion. But for now, let's hear what the Buddha had to say about all this. For the sake of all beings, wisdom, compassion, and non-clinging awareness. May we treat ourselves with the deepest compassion, the way we would at our very, very best if we were helping a dear friend. The Buddha was an extraordinary psychologist. An extraordinary physician in terms of diagnosing from the symptoms, the illness, prescribing medicine that would lead to a cure. I'm not going to do a long discourse on the Four Noble Truths. I've given a series of talks on that recently in our public Nanaimo classes, but I want to remind us all that at the most simple level, the illness is suffering. Discontent, unsatisfactoriness, this word dukkha, D-U-K-K-H-A from the Pali, the language spoken at the time of the Buddha that the original discourses would have been spoken in, is usually translated as suffering into English. But really a more accurate translation, according to scholars, would be unsatisfactoriness. And I think that's important because I think in English we think of suffering as a biggie, right? If someone says, I'm suffering, it generally means really big stuff, big grief, big anger, big loss, big anxiety. I think those are the gross sufferings, and they're very easy for us to identify with. We can certainly point to our big sufferings. But what about the tiny, almost unnotable moments of unsatisfactoriness? Like maybe you're in this room, in this chapel, and you're feeling wonderful in your heart and your mind. You're feeling hopeful and interested, but you're a little bit too hot or you're a little bit too cold and you don't have a tantrum about it. You kind of notice it with just a little twinge, just a little twinge of, I wish it was cooler in here. I wish it was warmer. Can't they turn the heat up? And you don't take it any further. You don't build a big story. You don't draw in or create, whether you mean to or not, big emotions about it, which we also can do. Let's be honest. We can have quite the tantrum about why can't these foolish people get the heat right or whatever. But this isn't one of those times. You're in a good state. You're feeling warm, loving, happy, and just a little, little chilly, a little too hot. And then you come back to feeling good. Those little moments of dissatisfaction are dukkha as well. And I emphasize that tonight because I want to emphasize that even with the little discomforts, what we tend to do is we're always micro-adjusting so we feel better, right? So if you're in a sit and you're a little too hot, you might take your shawl off, and then you're a little too cold and you put it back on. And you might not be, as I said, having a tantrum or making up a story, but you're adjusting. You're adjusting why? Because we want to feel good. We want to be comfortable. And if we're honest, we want to be absolutely comfortable all of the time, continually. That would be, you know, nirvana. Not really, but that would be it. That would be, oh, all the time I just feel good. The temperature's always just right. Like Goldilocks in your whole life, right? Except an enlightened Goldilocks. So you're not so much the, oh, it's too hot, oh, it's too cold. You're just always just right. Oh, the bed's too hard. Oh, the bed's too soft. No, it's just right. Oh my goodness, everything's just right. It's just the right amount of salt on your food. It's just the right amount of drama in your television show. It's just the right amount of cuddling from your cat, but not so much that you can't sleep. Oh, it's exhausting. It's exhausting to be micromanaging our life a lot of the times on purpose, and we're aware we're doing it. And a lot of the times, a great deal of the times, we're making small adjustments to feel better and we're not even aware of it. We all do it in meditation sits. Little shiftings of our weight, bigger shiftings. I had some pain come up, nothing terrible. And so I had to uncross my one ankle. Well, I didn't have to. I could have stayed with it, which at other retreats I do. I stay with the discomfort. I bring compassion to the discomfort. I move through the discomfort. Other times I might choose to adjust, but it's in the seeking of comfort, the seeking of good. And then good's good for a while. And then something else needs a little micro adjustment. Oh, micro adjustment. I'm not saying those things are bad. I just want to draw our attention to how we're consistently tweaking to feel better. What would it be like if we just felt better? Even if there's a sore ankle or a sad mind, but that we felt good. This is really, I don't love the word goal here, but I'll use it lightly. It's the goal of practice. It's not, but let's say one of the outcomes we desire of practice is that we feel good even when we're uncomfortable. Right? We feel good even when we're sad, which sounds a little odd in Western thinking, but it's back to that vastness of shared common humanity and that we can be grieving, but also held in the arms of the knowledge that everybody in this room has grieved and we're not alone. So the Buddha was a great psychologist because he diagnosed the mental illness, so to speak, of suffering. And then he diagnosed the cause. That's pretty important. If you go to a doctor tomorrow, and I hope you don't need to, with really searing abdominal pain, it could be a lot of things, right? It could be appendicitis. It could be food poisoning. It could be a twisted bowel and on and on and on. And you want a good diagnosis. You want an accurate diagnosis for the cause of your pain. So the accurate diagnosis for the cause of our mental, emotional pain and suffering and discontent is that we want things to be just right. The perfect Goldilocks, all the time, everything. That's the cause of the symptoms of suffering. The cause of the symptoms of suffering is not accepting the truth of change, not accepting the really obvious truth, if you're in a human body and mind, that there'll be some tough stuff that's going to come. A hard rain is going to fall, and sometimes you'll get wet. But it wouldn't satisfy me if I went to a doctor about my terrible gut pain, and they said, yeah, it's definitely an inflamed appendix, and that's all they did. I would want a treatment. I would want, ideally, a cure. I would want it fixed. So the Buddha, of course, gives us a treatment, which is stop clinging. What does that mean? Stop wanting things to be perfect all the time. Stop wanting things to be the way you want them to be. They won't be some of the time. That's the nature of reality. So that stopping clinging is stopping trying to control things you can't control, as someone was asking wisely about today. And accepting things as they are, even when they're really stinky, even when they're awful or not very pleasant or kind of tough or heart-wrenchingly tough. to accept that this is the truth of what is. My friend has died, and that's the truth. Accept the truth. And then, if you go to the doctor, you have the symptoms, suffering, and they diagnose the cause, clinging, wanting things to be the way you want, and then they don't give you a cure, you'd be rather discontented. The cure here is stop clinging. That's pretty hard for most of us to immediately do the first time we hear it, or we'd all be Buddhas by now. So the Buddha, in his vast excellence as a compassionate being, said, well, here are eight things you can practice, do, explore, the eightfold path of Buddha Dharma, the fourth noble truth of Buddha Dharma that will help you cling less and be in equanimity or grace with the nature of reality more. And you can look those up. I teach on them. Many great teachers, far greater than I, teach on them. But effectively, that is having a good or a wholesome attitude or view, a good or a wholesome intention, a good or a wholesome conduct, behavior, action, good or wholesome speech, internal and external, good or wholesome livelihood, how you spend your days making money or being retired or giving and receiving, good or wholesome effort, good or wholesome concentration, and good or wholesome mindfulness. Just say that briefly for now. You can look it up easily. Just say, what are the eightfold path of Buddha Dharma? What are the four noble truths? But I want us to mention those. So the prescription is work on all these aspects of your being and your life. Improve them. Be more compassionate. Be more wise. So the Buddha's teaching is extraordinary in that in four short sentences, he diagnosed the cause, the cure, and the path to all our suffering. Now, I spent, in my own way, without using that language, that's what I was trying to figure out from the time I was a little kid and through 13 years of university in sciences and psychology, was trying to figure out why we're not happier. Why are us middle-class, blessed Canadians not happier? And I didn't get a concise answer. I got a lot of deep and interesting teachings and trainings with some of the best people in the world, very blessed. But I didn't walk out of my PhD or my postdoc at the top school in the United States. I was accepted to both of them. I chose the one that worked best for what I wanted to learn. Tons of scholarships. I did not walk out of that training with an answer. So why do people suffer? I could have written a dissertation, confusing and highfalutin, but I couldn't answer it. And then I heard the Four Noble Truths and went, well, that was a waste of 13 years. Well, not really. But the pithiness of, oh. Now, there's two people in this room, many more, I'm sure, but I'm going to share two stories without using their names. One of them said to me quite a few years ago that she was sitting at her desk, I believe, in a desk chair, one of those twirly desk chairs, and thinking about or reading about the Four Noble Truths and kind of got it. And it was like a eureka moment. And she said, I was so excited, I twirled around in my chair three times and then I phoned my son to tell him. That's the right reaction to when you hear, that's why I suffer? And there's a cure? Hallelujah, twirl around in your chair and phone your kid. There's another person in this room who 10 years ago came to this retreat, their first exposure to the Buddha Dharma. And that retreat, I taught on the Four Noble Truths. And they had a major wake-up call sitting in a chair just where you are. I can stop suffering. It's me that's causing it. It's me clinging to wanting things that's causing it. And it changed the trajectory of their life. They started studying Dharma. They found an extraordinary teacher they had a connection with. Beautiful. So I share those to give everyone hope and also a deep bow to the two persons whose stories I've just shared, that the Buddha said, maybe there are some with just a little dust in their eyes. And that meant, let me back up a little to give context to that quote. The Buddha became awakened under the Bodhi tree. And previous to that, he'd been studying for many years with, I think, four companions who were deeply meditating with him and on the path to ceasing suffering. But the Buddha figured it out. And he'd left and he'd been kind of maybe a little maligned for leaving that path that his friends were still studying. And he was walking and he ran into his three or four old compatriots. And they took one look at him and knew something's happened. This guy's awake. Something's happened. And they said, what's with you, buddy? Or whatever they said in Pali. And he said, I am awake. And they said, please teach us. Please tell us. And he did. And apparently, I have to check it. I haven't told this story in a long time. I didn't look it up today. But I think two of them immediately became awake Buddhas. And the other two were quickly thereafter followed. And this, you must share this. You must share this teaching with the world. And the historical Shakyamuni Buddha said, I'm not sure that I could, like, I'm not sure people could hear this or understand it. And they said, please, please, you must. And the Buddha said, there may be some with only a little dust in their eyes. And then he went to the deer park in Sarnath outside Varanasi, India, and he gave the first teaching on the Four Noble Truths. So we only have a little dust in our eyes. When we hear this, our elephant goes, Murr! That was more of a horse than an elephant, but bear with me. It's been a long retreat. I got to practice my elephant trumpet. Maybe like that. And when you hear the Four Noble Truths and twirl around in your chair or sit out there and go, I'm causing my suffering? Holy smokes, there's something I can do about that. That's the dust being blown out of your eyes. But perhaps those two people didn't immediately become Buddhas. And so we keep training, we keep listening, we keep studying. So the Buddha was a great psychologist, a great physician for the disease of suffering. So I wanted to bring you that contextual reminder this evening. So a few things I feel moved to share. There's a samurai saying or poem, it's a single line, I make of my mind my friend. I make of my mind my friend. And that's really what we've been on about so far in this self-compassion retreat. Does it feel like your mind's your friend all the time? Not mine. Sometimes, yes. My mind's been quite a good friend for this retreat. But if a day before this retreat, my mind didn't feel like a very good friend at all. It was worried and concerned and obsessing about things that my bigger mind was saying, it's not that big of a deal, Cheryl's mind. And Cheryl's mind was going, yes, it is. Yes, it is. We're all going to die, more or less. More or less. Not being my friend at all. Being quite a jerk, actually. But the desire, the craving, that more healthy craving is for freedom. Freedom from what? Freedom from suffering. So let's continue to work on making our mind our friend, which we've been doing this weekend. That takes some patience, doesn't it? Anybody get a little frustrated with the mind? And then we come to the self-compassion, because when we're frustrated with the mind, we tend to be quite unkind to it. So self-compassion, that's where we can take these self-compassion breaks you've been learning about, which is to stop. It's like, oh, why am I obsessing about X? Obsessing is happening. This hurts. Other people struggle with this too. I'm not alone. Can I be kind to this moment that is so tough? Or whatever variation of those phrases. So what I've been attempting to draw your attention to and to practice together are really what I sometimes call a happy mind and a peaceful heart, or a peaceful mind and a happy heart. So the peaceful mind part is the mindfulness practice of calming and, well, at least inviting the mind to calm. Inviting the mind to calm. Sometimes, you know, it refuses the invitation, but then you re-extend it. So working with inviting the mind to calm, to settle, to focus for a breath or 10 or a sit or a day. So working to have the mind be more peaceful. I'm going to speak a bit more about that in a moment. And then working to have a happy heart, an open heart, a radiant heart, an unguarded heart within reason, and a heart that not only can find compassion for the little kitten in the snow, but for someone you don't really care for and you find to be very difficult, but who's going through a tough time, and you empathize with the tough time, even if you don't care for the personality of that being. And an open, warm heart to oneself, which we've many of us have identified is really tough. Isn't that, I was going to say heart-wrenching, and so I will. Isn't that heart-wrenching that many of us find it difficult to love this precious human being? Many of you are parents, grandparents, or have been around children, have little children in your life, or you can think of nieces, nephews, etc., your neighbor's little kids. Would you want those children to grow up not loving themselves? What a dreadful thing. What a dreadful thing. And yet we do that to ourselves, to our child, to the child in here. So really working to cultivate a peaceful mind and a happy heart. Now, I'm going to share this way of thinking about how our mind works that I really appreciate. I first heard it from a teacher called Anushka in a retreat 12, 14 years ago down in Joshua Tree, California. So I'll attribute it to her. I think she attributed it to someone else, but I don't know the root source. And the idea is you can think of your mind like kind of an undisciplined traveler in a big train station, a big subway station. I go to New York City quite a bit. I'm quite a theater buff. It's one of my passions. I usually get there once, sometimes twice a year. And I go on the subway. And if you're in Grand Central Station or the Times Square Station, there's many, many, many different trains coming and going different directions. If you get on the right train in the wrong direction, it gets a bit hinky, et cetera, et cetera. And your mind is, tell me if this relates. Tell me if this feels familiar, that your mind is kind of like a dopey person wandering around the subway, getting on whatever train calls its attention first. And not even necessarily looking at the destination and not even realizing what you've done. So you're wandering around, being in a pretty good state, and suddenly someone texts you something that triggers you, and before you know it, boom, you're on the annoyance train. You didn't plan it, but you're on the annoyance train. Holy. And if you're not skillful, it takes you a stop or two to realize you're on the annoyance train. And then you're really annoyed. I didn't want to be on this train. And then you throw a tantrum about being on the annoyance train. And now you're way more annoyed, and you're way further down the track. And it takes you longer to get off. It takes you longer to trudge all the way back to where you began. And then you get on the self-congratulatory train. And then that works for a while. And then you get on the I'm so tired train because you had a tantrum, and tantrums are exhausting. And does it feel sometimes like you're just on these freaking trains you didn't choose, you didn't want to be on, and you don't know where they're going? It feels that way to me sometimes. So what would it be if you went into your metaphorical train station and you read the signs carefully? And you went, oh yeah, the anger train. I've spent a lot of time on that train. It's never been good to me. It's never delivered me to a worthwhile destination. In fact, I know where this goes. It goes to anger and then rage and then exhaustion and then self-pity. It's a crappy train. How about I don't get on that train? But that's high-level skill. It is. So medium level skill would be, la, 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 I'm on a train. I'm on the anger train. How the hell did that happen? I don't know, but get off. Right? A lot of my work is with romantic couples. So we talk a lot about how to get off the anger train, right? You're triggered by your partner. You're bickering, or worse, it's just nasty, or just kind of, oh, you're pissing me off. It's like, stop. Get on a different train. Get on the self-compassion train. In fact, today I decided that in January, I do a once-a-month advanced coaching for the couples I work with. I'm going to actually teach self-compassion. What could be better than in your romantic relationship? I'm married to an idiot. May I have compassion for myself? Whatever variation. I'm just keeping it real. Norm doesn't relate to that at all, apparently. It is tough to be married to this person. Marriage is tough. Common humanity, all marriages are tough. I am not alone. Kindness, and yet this is a more or less good person. And can I see through this moment of anxiety or anger, etc.? Right? So watch out what you do in the train station. And here's another thing. There may be trains that we spend very little time on, because we're nervous about them, or we simply don't look at them, or we simply don't know. Like, what about the peaceful contentment train? Or the, I trust that the destination will be all right, even though I don't know where we're going train. That's a really interesting idea. Because guess what? None of us know what the destination is. We don't know what the destination is in an hour from now. We think we know. We'll be walking to our room at Bethlehem Center or walking mindfully to our car and driving carefully home. And we expect our home to still be there. It might have burned down, but don't worry, the cat got out. We don't know, and I'm not being facetious. Many of you know my closest friend. I was in the Santa Rosa fires in 2017 or 2018, and we ran for our lives. Well, the freeway was on fire and the buildings were on fire. 67 people were burned to death that night. We could have easily been four more of them. We weren't, blessedly, but her house and her entire subdivision was reduced to ash. Ash. About 40 houses. Ash. Nothing. We think our home will be there tonight. I hope it is too. But the point is quite simple. We never know what's going to happen, but we spend, monkey mind spends so much time trying to create security, right? Lots of RRSPs, paying off the mortgage, nailing it down with a marriage certificate that you will love me forever now, because you said so, till death do us part. Funny, not funny, right? But it's a promise that gives us security for a while. Maybe for a long while, if we keep renewing and deepening that connection. And paying off a mortgage feels like security till your house burns down. So I'm not saying any of these things are bad, but what I'm pointing out is we believe we've got it figured out. We believe that by paying off the mortgage and saying I do and signing papers about these things, that now it's settled. That part's settled. I've got someone with me for a long, long time. In a house we'll be in for a long, long time, and money that won't disappear when there's a stock market crash. So the train, I can't remember what I just called it because I'm riffing, but the train of, I don't really know where it's going, but that's okay. Wherever it goes, I'll still be fine, is actually the true experience of the human life. You get that? It really is the true experience of the human life. We don't know where the train is going. We don't know what will happen tomorrow. And wherever and whatever happens will be okay until we draw our last breath. I wish I could live on that train. I wish when there are worries about security or money or the future, I could be on the, well, I don't know where it's going and I don't know what it's going to look like, but whatever happens, I'll be okay train. And when I am, I'm calm. And when I'm not calm. I'm slightly overstating, but not very much. So think about that. An undisciplined mind, an untrained mind, no pun intended, an untrained mind, just gets on all sorts of trains and you're not running the show. Versus have more awareness, read the signs, learn the signs. Pay attention to the direct experience of what it's like to be on the sadness train, the grief train, the anxiety train, the self-pity train. And I'm not meaning to say that we can just step off that train and have those feelings go away. I dearly wish it was that easy. I dearly wish that your intelligence and your willpower was enough for you to just go, oh, there's anxiety present. I'm going to get off the anxiety train. Poof, the anxiety's gone. There are biophysiological processes, hormones, cortisol, and other things. But when you attempt to get off the anxiety train and or realize you're on that train and you bring in some self-compassion or the I love myself anywhere train, or I could go seek out a hug from someone I trust train. You're at least not just laying down on the floor of that subway car and letting it take you wherever. So thanks to Anushka and whoever I think she was quoting for that lovely analogy. A lot of us don't have a schedule or a plan for life. We think we do. But one of the things I dropped into that guided meditation this afternoon, may or may not have resonated for you, no problem, was 3 months from now, the 3 months from now you, how does he or she or they get up in the morning? What do they do in the morning? Do they have a morning routine in the morning? I was quite purposeful that I dropped that in. Because if one institutes a wholesome morning routine of 5 minutes long or 2 hours long, depending on your circumstances, it can make quite a difference to your day. And you might be like, what do you mean by a healthy routine? Well, something like you wake up in the morning and before you get out of bed, even if your bladder is quite full, you put your hand on your heart and you think, may I be well and happy? May I be a good being today? May I give gratitude for this day? Or whatever variation of a gratitude, a Dharma prayer. You know, like my dad says, it's a great day. I woke up on the right side of the dirt, right? Lots of our elders say that. He's quite right. Got a great attitude. Lots of physical pain and rotten stuff going on. Just like, yahoo, 82 and kicking butt. It's a great day. Still standing. I woke up today. But imagine you started the day with 60 seconds, 2 minutes of just self-compassion, or if there's someone four-legged or two-legged in the bed with you, have a little pat or a little smooch, just gratitude. Imagine if you got up and maybe you had to pee, and then instead of immediately drinking a bunch of coffee and looking at the news on your phone, please never do that. Don't look at your phone. Leave it. Turned off. Airplane mode. For at least half an hour or 3 hours. It's up to you, but a lot of research to show the negative impact of that. But imagine you got up, and then circumstances allowing, you meditated for X amount of minutes. Did a bit of stretching. Watched the sunrise. If you share your home with beings, maybe had a lovely little bit of breakfast or a beverage and checked in with each other. Not just the minutiae, which need to be checked in on, of who's doing what and who's picking up who, but also, you know, how you doing, love? Imagine if you started your day in a wholesome way, as a ritual, the way you might jog, the way you might have your coffee and your oatmeal and hit the gym. Those are all good things, but they're not as good of things as some sort of gratitude, kindness, meditation, prayer. Even 10 minutes of a morning routine can make a big difference. There's a book. Who's it by? Personal growth kind of book. Tim Ferriss, who's a podcast host, has a book called Tools of Titans. I'm not necessarily recommending you run out and get it. It's just the concept's really cool. He interviewed, I can't remember how many, let's say 50 top achievers across all genres, you know, top artists, top athletes, top business persons, entrepreneurs, personal growth specialists, authors, and so on. And he looked for commonalities. He asked them all these questions, and he looked for commonalities in how they kind of live their life. And something like 85% of them had a morning routine. Really interesting. When you have a morning routine, you're choosing your trains from the minute you wake up. You're setting yourself up to do perhaps a wiser choice of what trains you get on later. Instead of the alarm goes off and, you know, we call it an alarm, right? Oh, you're alarmed. You get out of bed and you're like going and checking and busy and checking your email. It's like, who chose that? Who chose that chaotic, stressful way to start your day? I like that more and more. I run an online business, so unfortunately, because I don't care for it, I have to spend a fair bit of time on email. But I really like that I'm seeing more and more in some of my wiser colleagues in the business world that they have little signatures on their email. You'll be seeing this too, where it says, I check my email at 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. Pacific time or something. They're setting up an expectation. Don't assume I'm going to check my email first thing and get right back to you. Absolutely brilliant. Because when you're reacting to other people's needs, you're never on balance. The worst things you can do in terms of productivity is check your email in the morning, because you're immediately got all these little trivial things that other people need from you, some of them important, and it's blown away your most important thing. So I'm pulling in different things here, but around how do you want to live your life 3 months from now, 3 minutes from now, 3 days from now? Do you want to live on automatic pilot the way too many of us do, just having an idea of what train we're on, and then this train comes and someone else needs it, and we're on that one, and then it's 4 o'clock and you finally get to your really important deliverable for your business, for your clients, for your life, for your health, and you do it with your worst energy at the most dull time of the day? Right? Put what's most important first. What's most important? I very much want that to be my mental and physical well-being, my family, etc., that those come first. Doesn't mean you can't work hard. I'll work hard. but you can work smart. So be careful of the trains you get on. This is all self-compassion. Is it self-compassionate to jump up, drink 3 cups of coffee, and check the news? No! Might it feel good? Yeah, it might. Temporarily, it might feel good. It's not compassionate. You don't have to believe me. Try it both ways and see the evidence of your own experience. That's the very best way to try these ideas on in the evidence of your own experience. And when there is unpleasantness, get on a different train. And here's a beautiful thing. At first, we can realize we're on a negative train. Then we can maybe get off the negative train. Eventually, we can get better at not getting on the negative train in the first place. And eventually, what happens on a train line that nobody ever gets on? It gets discontinued. Imagine that. Imagine if the anxiety train got discontinued. High five, Alexis. High five everybody in this room. That may sound fanciful. That's what freedom from suffering is the absence of anxiety, sadness, etc. I'm very, very far from that yet. But the train runs less often, it's less of a loud train, and I get off it more skillfully more often. This is a good thing. Maybe it only runs on late nights and weekends, especially about 3 in the morning, the odd time, the anxiety train, you know, it's got a weird schedule, right? But the point is, we do have control over this, not absolute control, or we'd all just walk out and go, excellent, I'm never getting on the self-pity train ever again. And you wouldn't, but it's not that simple. But we have control by recognizing I have control. I have a say in what the mind does. And right now it's a pretty big monkey with a very big voice, but I have a say over gradually befriending it, gradually bringing it really nummy bananas, asking it what it needs, asking it, you want to try a different train with me, monkey? We have a choice. Exert it. You're all exerting it. That's why you're here on this retreat. There's a writer, many of you may know her work, Anne Lamott. She wrote a beautiful book called Bird by Bird about writing, and she's written other things. She's a glorious writer and a Dharma practitioner. And I don't remember if I heard this in a talk or read it in one of her books, but she said, my mind is like a dangerous neighborhood. I really don't like to hang out there. Doesn't that say it all? Anybody relate? My mind is like a dangerous neighborhood. I really don't like to hang out there. But let's make your mind a luscious neighborhood with waterfalls and pandas and koalas and beautiful things and kindness and interest and curiosity. And that's what we're doing, believe it or not. That's what we're doing this weekend, is we're cultivating a better neighborhood in the mind. Now, apply this to your direct experience. You don't have to share this out loud, but what unwholesome trains did you get on this weekend? Right? Your beautiful shares in our interviews, someone was talking about getting on kind of a guilt and shame train, worrying about various things, guilt and shame. And someone else was talking about getting on, you know, the anxiety, I'm not good enough train. And someone else was talking about endlessly planning train. It's kind of helpful. It's not a one-to-one, take this to the bank kind of relationship, but the tendencies of the mind in retreat sometimes fairly accurately show us the tendencies of the mind out of retreat. You know, what are kind of our top 5 hits of gruesome things our mind thinks about all the time? You know, what are our defaults? What are our top 2 or 3 stories that tend to run? It's interesting, in a really long retreat, sometimes we map these, like we write them down and kind of get what are the top 2 or 3 themes that run for this being? I'm not good enough. Everybody else is stupid. I can never do it. whatever it is. And you'll generally find, yeah, there's themes. Different language sometimes, but the same theme. And that's really kind of helpful. Then you know that that's a train that's really running a lot through your train station. And you can start to spot it more effectively. So we've been talking about many things, but self-compassion and the difficulty, the dukkha of life and change, and how when we become more in alignment with the truth of that change, when we're more kind to our reactions to the difficulties, we suffer less. And I found a beautiful poem by Jennifer Wellwood called Unconditional. And I would say this is very in synchronicity with the self-compassion work. Willing to experience aloneness, Willing to experience aloneness, I discover connection everywhere. Turning to face my fear, I meet the warrior who lives within. Opening to my loss, I gain the embrace of the universe. Surrendering into emptiness, I find fullness without end. Each condition I flee from pursues me. Each condition I welcome transforms me and becomes itself transformed into its radiant, jewel-like essence. I bow to the one who has made it so, who has crafted this master game. To play it is purest delight. To honor its form, true devotion. So when each condition I flee from pursues me, ever notice that? But each condition I welcome transforms me. The self-compassion, can I be with this as it is instead of fleeing from it or trying to shove it away? Just say, there is grief present. Can I hold that gently and allow it to transform? Maybe quickly, maybe not. To maybe appreciation for that which we had until he, she, it, they was gone. That's to me how I read part of that meaning that that poet has given us. So I wanted to give you a few words about how to work with difficult emotions in and above with the self-compassion practice. And anger is a good one because anger is quite a hot emotion, you know. And Thich Nhat Hanh, the extraordinary teacher, writer, and beautiful being who's now left the planet in body form, he tells us to take care of our anger. Interesting, eh? It's generally not a Western psychology sort of view. Take care of your anger. Don't act on it or repress it. He says, hold it in your arms. Shine compassion on it, and it cracks open, and we will see its roots. I find that very moving, you know? Very moving. I used an example in the last couple of days, I don't remember which day, of if you've adopted a rescue animal that might have had a rough past, and it's generally a funny, sweet, loving creature, and you reach toward it one day, and it bites you or scratches you, then it means it's likely in fear or in pain. And if we can hold that gently, shine our compassion on it, probably that creature will melt in our arms. We'll be able to soothe it out of anger, out of reactivity. This is the way we can soothe our own anger, our own hurt. Hold it. This is hard and it shouldn't be. And what I mean there is because of the self-judgment, the self-criticism, even the self-hatred, most of us do not automatically go, oh, Cheryl's yucky anger. Hey, come here, kiddo. I got you. You're safe. We'll be okay. Let me love you. It's that easy. Instead, it's, what's wrong with me? I'm such a jerk. Blah. Really work on this, guys. Really work on befriending and being kind to the state. Remember the first night? Oh, low, so many days ago, only three, two and a half. But I talked about an emotion's just a temporary state, right? It's just a temporary state in the mind. It arises. Fred Von Elman, a beautiful teacher. I sat at a retreat with him in Thailand a long time ago, 1997 or something. And he had a way of saying it in his Swiss German accent that I can't really mimic. He said, you know, everything arises. It does its little dance, and then it passes away. Every breath does that. Every relationship does that. Every life does that. It arises, it does its little dance, and it passes away. So that's all the mind state of anger is. It arises, it does its little dance, breaks a few things, and passes away. And when we keep reminding ourselves of that, write it on a post-it note, stick it on the fridge. Emotions arise, do a dance, and pass away. Remind yourself. Seriously, I did a four-month Abhidhamma retreat. Abhidhamma is a very deep philosophical aspect of the teachings, quite dense, quite intellectual, quite rich, quite beautiful. And as part of it, I was sharing a house with another meditator in silence for 4 months. We didn't really know each other till after. I didn't know she had kids and a husband till after the 4 months. It was really cool. And we had post-it notes all over the place with moments like in the cupboard where the cups were. There was a post-it note that said, what was the moment before? And what it meant was, as we mindlessly reached for the cupboard, what was the moment before? Can we catch the moment where a decision was made, maybe while you were meditating, to go have a cup of tea, which led to the karma of getting up and walking in and reaching for the cupboard? And was that wholesome or not? Were you aware of it or not? Was it a conditioned pattern or not? Post-it notes everywhere. Post-it note your life with reminders. Are you practicing self-compassion? Put that on your toothbrush. Okay? Have you told yourself how lovely you are today? Put that on your steering wheel of your car. Can be really helpful because it's so easy to forget everything you're practicing when you're back in the conditioned patterns of daily life, running from one thing to the next, not stopping and just going, and then continuing. So I really hope you'll do some variations of that yourself. That's most of what I wanted to cover today. I'll say a little more tomorrow before we close. But there's another poem, or maybe two, I would like to share with you, which is the beauty of the arts, is sometimes they capture things so eloquently that speak to our very soul and help us go, yes, yeah. Yeah, that saying what I was feeling or capturing what I was thinking, that's helpful. This is a beautiful piece called Love After Love by Derek Walcott. And listen to this in terms of its beautiful description of self-compassion. The time will come when, with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you have ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit. Feast on your life. Greet yourself arriving at your own door. We did a variation of that. I didn't realize that, but that line is what we did this afternoon. You greeted yourself arriving at your own door in that visualization. And a beautiful poem many of you will know, perhaps almost by heart. I mentioned a line of it in one of the groups today, and I said I'd read this tonight. It's the poem by Mary Oliver called Wild Geese. And again, listen to this through the lens of self-compassion. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clear blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination. Calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things. Common humanity. Mary Oliver was also a Dharma practitioner.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Sex, Love, and Elephants. But most of all, thank you for being part of this herd. If you enjoyed listening, please share this with a friend. And if you haven't already, I would love, love, love it if you would subscribe, rate, and review the show on your podcast player, because it really helps all the other elephants find us. If you have any questions or comments or maybe an idea for the show, or you'd like to be a guest, reach out to me directly at drcherylfraser.com, where you can also sign up for weekly Love Bites, science-based tips for creating love and passion that last a lifetime.